This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's California Politics Today. We're about to speak with Dana Cody, who represents two of the plaintiffs in the constitutional case against Proposition 71. Welcome back to California Politics Today.
Thank you.
Tell us the two plaintiffs that you do represent in this case.
People's Advocate and the National Tax Limitation Foundation.
Okay. There was a hearing today in Hayward. You were there. Tell us what happened.
Well, all the questions that were asked in the tentative ruling were answered by attorneys for all the parties represented, and the court took the case under submission and will render a decision. She didn't really say when, but she'll. I believe she said she'd fax it to all the parties.
Okay. Did you get the feeling that it would be soon or later?
I got the feeling it'll be somewhat quick. I wouldn't be surprised if I got something tomorrow, but, it could take longer. I think the judge, based on her questions and the things that were raised today, which, I mean, none of it was surprising. It was mostly what was in the questions in the tentative ruling. I think she's being very careful and, several times one of the parties would refer to something in their pleadings. She had it right there in front of her, so she's read everything, and she's very aware of what's in our brief.
Okay. Who all was there in court today besides Judge Sabara?
There was Tamar Pachter for the Attorney General. The attorney for amicus in support of the defendant's motion was there. I cannot remember his name. I apologize for that.
What organization was he from?
He's just with a law firm that wrote the amicus brief.
Oh, okay.
And James Harrison, who I believe represents the ICOC, these two were in the audience. They didn't participate. So Tamar Pachter handled oral argument for all the defendants.
Okay. And the plaintiff's argument was handled by you and was anyone else?
Plaintiff's argument, we had Robert Taylor was there, Terry Thompson, and myself. And at this hearing, Robert Taylor and Terry Thompson did the arguing. I just sat and took notes.
Okay.
And then David Llewellyn was there with his partner, and David did oral argument. His partner was in the audience.
Okay. Could you say a little bit about the questions that were addressed and what was there much of an audience there besides the people you've just mentioned?
I would say there were anywhere from 15 to 20 people, and they were mostly from the media.
Okay.
And I think there were one or two citizens that were interested, but I think in large part it was the media.
Okay. So this is going to be a way for the people who weren't there to find out what happened.
Right.
What were some of the major questions that the court wanted to know about, and briefly, what did you say about them, and what did the defendants say about it?
Well, the major question she had for us was, if I were to grant the motion and your complaint was to be, I was to find judgment on the pleadings for the defendant.
For the defendant?
Yes,
for
the Stem Cell Institute.
Right.
And not even necessarily judgment on the pleadings. If I were to agree that there is no facial challenge, should you be given an opportunity to amend your complaint to include the as-applied challenge, which means taking the facts of how the ICOC has operated thus far and applying it to the law. So she asked us about that. We talked a little bit about why conflict of
Before you talk about conflict of interest, so the judge asked then both parties to address the issue.
Yes.
Of if the defendant's argument that you didn't have a case on the face of the language of the Constitution and the proposition, would you then want to or be in a position to argue that the implementation of that law was violative of either the Constitution or other statutes?
Right.
Is that what she was asking you to talk about?
Right, and that would be what is called the as-applied challenge.
Okay. And what did the defendant say, and what did you say about that?
Well, we said that there were lots of facts. I mean, we didn't go into great detail, but yes, we could make an as-applied challenge. And,
okay.
And the defendant said something like, "Well, if you're going to allow them to amend and have an as-applied challenge, I think you should find out what that might be,
right,
to see if it has substance to it, so we can move this case along." And that was one thing that Bob Taylor pointed out in his oral argument. Hey, wait a minute here. There's this undercurrent that we're holding things up. We were the first ones to file our complaint. We haven't held things up. It's just, you know, there was a motion for judgment on the pleadings months ago that the Attorney General took off calendar.
Right.
So we're just going with the flow here, and so we're not the cause of the delay.
If there were to be an as-applied challenge, would that necessarily involve a trial, or could it involve a trial as opposed to this case,
yes,
right now, which just involves points of law?
Yes, it could involve a trial. Probably what would happen is, if the complaints were amended to include an as-applied challenge, then discovery would start, and then the parties would start bringing motions related to those facts and whether or not they were, enough to prove the case.
Right.
Yes, it could result in a trial.
Did the judge take up the request of the defendants to ask you to provide information about how that as-applied challenge would work to satisfy the judge at the request of the defendants that you had a case on that basis?
She didn't today, but she could in her tentative ruling.
She could ask you to essentially establish that.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Now, what about a conflict of interest?
Well, that was mostly argued by David Llewellyn, who just went through all the statutory law and made the point that the ICOC is the first alleged state agency that is exempt from the Political Reform Act and also from some other statutory provisions that escape me right now. But he made the point that, you know, you can't exempt people from these things, I believe it was Bob Taylor along the same line that made the point, you know, if you're a representative of a disease advocacy group and you make a decision related to the ICOC that your disease advocacy group doesn't like, they have the power to say, see ya, we didn't like that decision, you're fired.
Right.
Whereas, conversely, that's not true. If the voters didn't like a decision that was made, they have no power to remove, neither does the state. And so he just pointed, you know, further why conflicts of interest were dangerous and why that shows that the ICOC is outside the exclusive management control of the state.
Okay, and did the defendants respond to that criticism?
She didn't really.
Or the court?
Yeah, the Deputy Attorney General, I don't remember a detailed response, but she did respond to it in her brief. I don't really remember what she said in response to that today. I don't think a whole lot, because I would remember.
Okay. What other points besides the as-applied challenge and conflict of interest issues were raised?
There were some issues related to requests for judicial notice and whether the things that there were objections to all parties that had requested judicial notice. And, for example, one was an internal memo of an attorney from some state agency to somebody at the ICOC. I'd have to go back and look at my paperwork to give you a definite title. But
and what is the role of these challenges or this judicial notice?
Well, a court can take judicial notice of something that is reasonably beyond dispute. And so, for example, we wanted the court to take notice of a web page on the CIRM web page that says, "What is a CIRM?" Where
right.
They say, "We represent disease advocacy groups."
Right.
They never say anything about representing the people.
So this is essentially putting into evidence or making susceptible to the judge's consideration,
yes,
certain items of,
yes,
of text.
Yeah, and that was exactly the argument. Well, should it be evidence? Probably not, but yes, the court should take notice of it, and it's, you know, it's reasonably indisputable because anybody can get on the website and look to see what the ICOC has to say about who, or what the CIRM has to say about who they are. And the other thing that we brought to the court's attention in that regard is the fact that since the litigation has started, they've changed their definition of what is a CIRM, and it's more litigation correct, you know, litigation proof than it was previously, where they said we represent disease advocacy groups and state universities and nothing about representing the people of the state of California.
Had your side made copies of these web pages and
yes,
memorialized them somehow? And
yes,
had they been certificated in some way as being, or was there any argument about whether they actually had been posted in the past? Or
no argument. And they didn't need to be certified because they were, you know, reasonably reliable.
Again, did the defendant's attorney make any statements about including or excluding these documents?
She mainly argued that that the documents shouldn't be taken for the content, you know, the truth of what was asserted in the content, but rather that the court should just take a look at what it is that she, like, you know, in the Attorney General's case, what they were wanting to be judicially noticed, and, you know, take it for what it's worth, give it the weight it's considered.
Were there documents that they wanted rise to the level of judicial notice that you didn't?
Yeah, for example, a revised agenda from one of the ICOC meetings.
Okay.
That, who knows if that was the final copy or not.
Right. So are all of these items for judicial notice now going to be ruled on by the judge as part of the of her determinations?
Yes. She'll make that ruling in her final decision.
And will that be moot if she makes a decision one way or the other, or will it only be important if she decides to move forward in certain directions?
Well, it would be important in some future hearing, perhaps, or maybe a trial where you go back and look at the court record and say, oh, the court took judicial notice of this. But right now, for purposes of this decision, those things that she takes notice of, she may use to influence her decision, and those things that she does not take notice of, they won't factor into her decision.
Okay, so in other words, she has your pleadings, she has the defendants from the Attorney General's pleadings,
mm-hmm,
she has amicus briefs, and those are the documents she can look at in making her decision. But
right,
she also has been asked by both sides to include additional documents, and presumably she'll make that decision not separately but as part of her deliberation process, right? And she'll decide which ones she wants to consider, and then she'll consider them, and then she'll reach her decision having included the ones that she's at her discretion chosen to include. Is that
yes,
a fair representation?
That's a fair
okay.
Summary.
All right. So why don't we sort of move towards wrapping up by summarizing what the elements or the dimensions of the decision that she has indicated she's going to make are, what her options are, and then maybe talk a little bit about your expectations,
right,
in that regard.
She could rule that she could deny all the motions.
Right.
She could grant ours and not grant the defendants.
Right.
She could grant part of, because ours only have, well, we actually have two causes of action, one being the Article 16, Section 3, and then a taxpayer cause of action. She could, more likely what would happen as far as granting it partially would be David Llewellyn's complaint, California Family Bioethics Council. She might grant judgment as to part of his motion or not. And there was some argument about that, the Attorney General saying, I think you should grant it in part and give us some guidance, and then David Llewellyn saying, no, it has to, you know, it's one issue. It's not appropriate on a motion for judgment. You have to either grant it or not grant it. So, you know, if she decides to grant part of his motion and not the other part, I'm sure her decision will explain why she decided to go that way.
Was there any confusion or complication due to the combination of your two, the consolidation of your case with the case brought by Mr. Llewellyn in a single action here?
There wasn't any confusion as procedurally. I think what's confusing is something that I pointed to in our last conversation is, you know, the court has classified our complaint as a bond validation action.
Right, or more precisely a reverse bond validation action.
And,
right.
And it's not, even though, you know, we have to abide by the court's decision.
Right.
So when we make the point that we aren't talking about just bonds, we aren't talking about the CIRM, we're just talking about the ICOC and their authority to spend money, I think that it confuses the issue because, the real issue in our complaint is the spending of money. Even though we said we don't want them to be able to issue bonds, them
right.
being the ICOC,
right.
wasn't because we didn't want them to issue them per se, and we still take the position, let the CIRM issue all the bonds they want.
The CIRM or the
CIRM.
The Institute.
Yes.
Right.
The ICOC just can't spend them.
Okay, and it's the ICOC that you contend, or does anyone demur from, is the body that has the authority to spend that money under
yes.
Prop 71.
Yes.
So you're saying CIRM, the Institute, can issue the bonds and sell them, but the expenditure of those funds is under the control of the ICOC, which you contend is not under the control of the state of California.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Did the judge seem to understand the distinction that we've just made?
There's really no way to tell, and I think the judge does her homework, and she's very careful in what she does, and she may very well understand the distinction and disagree with us. But I think if she agreed with us, she wouldn't have consolidated the cases to begin with.
Right.
Our contention may.
Is that, in fact, a grounds for appeal?
Oh, most definitely.
In fact, the consolidation the consolidation of the two cases is itself a significant point that might come up in a future appeal.
Yes, I think grounds for appeal would be based on our constitutional challenge, obviously, and on the fact the case was consolidated. And in her in the decision where she says, it may not. Our complaint may not have been filed as a consolidation action, but it became one.
An invalidation action.
Yes, I think that's something that's appealable as well.
Did you appeal that previously?
No, we didn't.
Appeal the consolidation when it first took place?
No, we didn't.
Did you need to have in order to establish your standing to use that as a grounds for appeal later?
No, we didn't feel like we needed to, and the second reason we didn't need to is that David Llewellyn did appeal that decision, and I have to admit that I don't know what's happened to that appeal.
The last I heard from I think a clerk in the court there was that that appeal had not been granted
mm-hmm.
by the Alameda court.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, if it had been granted.
Then there would have been more going on. So I don't think they ignored it. I think they declined I don't know whether they declined to hear the appeal or whether they rejected the appeal. But in any case, it wasn't taken up and successfully. So, all you have to do now is wait, or you have more work to do while you're waiting.
Right now we're just waiting, and then we have to decide what to do next.
Okay, well then we'll all wait with you. And anything else you want to say before you go about today's court hearing? Was the mood friendly, collegial, antagonistic, neutral?
It was collegial among the attorneys. I just always find it really interesting that, Robert Klein, he's always got to, like today he was saying we're irrational. I mean, he just can't be polite. I don't know what his problem is.
Was he there?
Yeah, he was there.
Where did he make that? He obviously, there were no witnesses here. Did he make that comment to the press?
Yes. He came outside and the press just, they were fawning all over him. I think they think he's the reincarnation of Jesus Christ or something. I mean, I don't mean to be...
snippety.
But I guess I do. It's just amazing to me that can just be off all over themselves with this person.
What kind of questions was he asked?
I don't even know.
Oh.
I just left.
Oh, okay. did they ask you? Did they hover around you and ask you any questions?
They asked me a few questions, and
what was the press interested? What was the press interested in knowing from
they
you?
They were wanting to know if there were any surprises, or what do we expect the outcome to be? And
right.
And I just basically said, no, there are no surprises, and I'm not even going to guess what the outcome will be.
It was pretty much about the horse race rather than the issues involved, wasn't it?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Well, people who want to know about the issues involved can listen to these conversations.
And that is exactly why I talk to you.
Right, exactly. Well, and that's why people come and listen, so they can actually find out what the argument's all about.
Right.
And I appreciate your taking the time to talk to us about it today. And presumably, again, doing the next and the next and the next step in this interesting and important case.
Yes, and I guess the one point I want to make, and this was made by David Llewellyn during the hearing, that I think he made very well, which made the atmosphere more collegial, and was surprising to me that the comments were made after he had said this, but was the fact that we're all interested in cures, we're all interested in stem cell research. You know, there are currently, I was just reading an article, 65, I think it is, excuse me for pausing here.
It's okay.
I think it's 65 different therapies that are moving forward with adult stem cell research. And, yes, it says, this article is talking about embryonic stem cell therapy and how there isn't one single clinical embryonic stem cell therapy trial. A clinical trial. By contrast, adult and umbilical cord stem cells are already being used in treatment of 65 diseases. And so, you know, we all want cures. We just think that the way to go about it is with therapy that's already working and that we, you know, that isn't controversial. And so this was published in the Weekly Standard, and the person that wrote this article is Robert George, and he is on the President's Council for Bioethics. And so David Llewellyn was very gracious in making that point, because I know that there's one gentleman there whose son is paralyzed, and he's very interested in the outcome of this. And I think it's unfortunate that he's been given false hope, because there will be no cures for at least 20 years, if at all, through embryonic stem cell therapy. And he's been given false hope, and that is, to me, is very tragic, especially when they could be putting their energy into adult stem cell research where there are already 65, potential therapies. Not even potential, this article says. 65 therapies already in progress.
Where is that article in the National Standard?
The Weekly Standard.
Weekly Standard. I'll try to track it down and put a link to it.
And it's the author is Robert P. as in Paul George.
Robert P. George. All right. Good. Thank you very much for your time, and have a good time waiting, and we'll talk again, I hope, soon.
Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.